This is MSCI Perspectives, bringing to light insights and analysis that help global investors tackle today's challenges. I'm your host, Adam Bass, and today is May 23rd, 2024. On this episode, we continue our look at the voluntary carbon markets by speaking with an investor, someone on the ground, as they say. I recently had the chance to speak with Adam Gibbon. He's the natural capital lead at AXA IM and manages AXA IM's $500 million natural capital fund. Here's that conversation. Adam, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So for listeners that may not be completely familiar with AXA's investment approach, especially when it comes to impact investing, can you give us a quick summary of that?
Yes, certainly. So it emerged really from a challenge we set ourselves about a decade ago as we were establishing the impact investment platform. And that challenge was, can we make market rate returns and deliver impact at the same time? And over the last decade, we've been experimenting with numerous models, numerous sectors to try and make that work. And over that time, we've narrowed it down now to two pillars. So that's healthcare and climate. And within the climate side of things, we have a focus on climate technology, and then another on natural capital.
When you say natural capital, what is that exactly?
Yeah, so natural capital is the entire living world around us. So atmosphere, plants, animals, soils, and water. When we talk about natural capital investing, it's really activities that are either sustainably managing, protecting, or restoring those elements of natural capital. So for us, the type of activities we look at could be tree planting for conservation or for timber harvesting, could be the protection of forests from deforestation or land from degradation, or it could be the provision of household devices into emerging markets that reduce the need and the demand for unsustainable fuel reduce. So examples of that could be clean cooking or biodigesters.
And of course, we're talking about investing here. So how does this approach align with the idea of generating revenue, generating returns?
Yeah, then back to that original challenge, natural capital is perfect because businesses that generate revenues from restoring, sustainably managing or conserving natural capital do so through what's called payments for environmental services, PES. And generally then within that, it tends to be carbon. Companies that are paid for reducing or avoiding carbon emissions. And what that means in natural capital generally is that the more positive impact we have, so the more we sequester or avoid the release of CO2, the more revenues we generate. So impact and revenue generation in this case are very, very well aligned. And something interesting that we're also seeing is that people will pay for quality. So it's not just that one ton of CO2 trades for the same price from any project, but those with high greenhouse gas integrity and how they're measured and high social and environmental co-benefits go for higher prices.
So when you're choosing where to invest, Adam, are returns paramount or is it speed to impact? How does that play out?
One of the features of our fund is that it has a 15-year length. Natural capital investing takes time and it needs patient capital. That's because trees take time to grow, land use projects take time to have impact on the ground. That said, some project types do yield credits and revenues faster, and those tend to be those that reduce or avoid emissions. So to give you an example, one of our portfolio companies, Sistema Bio, what they do is manufacture and distribute biodigesters. So what happens is, once a biodigester is installed, instead of manure rotting and leading to greenhouse gas emissions within a farm, it's fed into the biodigester, which captures the methane that would have been emitted. Methane's a greenhouse gas, which is 25 times more powerful than CO2, and creates biogas, which can be used then to displace unsustainable fuel reduce, whilst also providing an organic fertilizer. Once these biodigesters are installed, they can be operating at full capacity very quickly and hence generating carbon credits at full capacity very quickly. If you contrast that to tree planting projects where they typically take about 3 to 7 years to reach their peak growth rates and sequestration.
When you're going about your day looking for which types of carbon projects to invest in, How do you go about it? What's your criteria?
Yeah, so the first thing is that we do invest in a broad range of projects, from tree planting to avoided deforestation, wetland restoration and conservation, and household devices. So we diversify across the project types. We're also quite clear that there's a need, both an imperative from the impact side of things and also commercially, to invest in projects that both reduce and remove emissions from the atmosphere. We can't only remove our way out of the climate change situation that we're in. We need dramatic cuts to emissions alongside dramatically scaled up removals as well.
Walk me through that. We've had discussions with some other guests around the idea of, like you said, quality credits, quality projects. There's no central governing body on this. How does AXA go about it? How does Adam Gibbon go about looking for these projects?
So first of all, it comes down to the experience of our team. AXA AM, we've been involved in the carbon markets now for over 10 years. So this has given us a lot of experience of how things have been evolving over the time and what high quality looks like from very much an insider perspective. When people think about carbon credit quality, the first thing they tend to think about is greenhouse gas integrity. So technically, things have been changing quite a lot over the last couple of years in the carbon world. There's been a flurry of new carbon methodologies and project types. We've got new oversight bodies like the VCMI. We've got rating agencies. I think all this is a good sign. The market's maturing and it's growing. But, you know, it can sound quite complicated. I think how we get through this is, first, the fundamentals that we come back to every time. Are we following the science, and are we being conservative? Those are the cornerstone questions that we're asking on every transaction that we're doing related to greenhouse gas integrity. But beyond that, of course, we have our specific system for how we look at greenhouse gas integrity. And to do that, we work with third-party consultants, we work with rating agencies, we have dialogue with the standard themselves to understand where the best practice is, not only today, but where it's going, and then the degree to which each opportunity we're looking at conforms. But I think going beyond just greenhouse gas integrity, there are other elements that we look at. ESG, or environmental social governance, is a big component of that. So we've developed our own ESG standard and requirement that all our projects and investments need to follow. This is built out of the IFC performance standards. And as part of our investment process, we assess on the ground, what are the risks to ESG? So what things socially and biodiversity could go wrong, and what systems are there in place to manage these? And then the outcome of our diligence process is a set of environmental and social action plans that we then monitor over the course of the investment. Finally, when it comes to quality, there is an element which comes much more down to a traditional underwriting and assessment of project finances and operations. So if you don't have a robust enterprise or strong financials, then a project's simply not going to thrive. So we use our more traditional investor hat to make sure that projects are robust on those grounds as well.
Can you give us an example of how this process played out for a specific project?
Yes, certainly. So we have made an equity investment into a company called Mumbak, and we also have a $58 million project financing agreement with them. Mumbak's business model is to plant mixed of native species on degraded cattle pasture and sell high-quality nature-based carbon removal credits, whilst also having big biodiversity impacts and social impact on the ground. Now, as part of our due diligence process, we took them through a process of making sure that their systems adhered to our ESG, our environmental social governance standard. This involved going out on the ground, speaking to operators, speaking with prospective landowners, and interviewing the whole team at Mumbak and assessing all their processes. We then set them up with an environmental social action plan, so a list of actions they needed to do to bring their processes in line with what we were requiring. As we went through this, it was there's a degree of work for the Mumbak team to go through it. At the end of the whole process, they said they're very satisfied, because when they've subsequently come on to selling credits, when the marketing credits, being able to hold up their ESG systems, which they've developed to us, to the highest standards, they've said it's been a real selling point in terms of getting the best possible prices for their credits.
And as you're going through this process, and just in general, obviously a lot of it, like you said, is you're talking with the company, but it's a lot of data gathering and analysis. How has this changed, if it has, over the last few years?
Yes, I mean, if you talk about data coming from land use projects, there is an incredible amount available today. So there's lots of sensors that you can deploy in the field, like camera traps, soundscape microphones, eDNA measurements, and remote sensing data, etc. I think more so than ever. It's really up to the developers now and investors to work out what is worth capturing, what's important, and what's actually cost effective. You know, a lot's been changing in this world. So to give you an example, we've been involved and have an equity stake in a company called Chloris Geospatial, who are revolutionizing forest biomass measurements. So 20 years ago, when I studied remote sensing, if you wanted to measure biomass in the forest across a landscape level, you'd have to take a satellite photo, stratify land use classes, so what's forest, what's non-forest, go into the field, measure small plots with tape measures, the diameters of the trees, and then extrapolate those plots across the stratified landscape. There were also and are today other more advanced methods like flying radars over the forest, but they're very expensive. But now with companies like Chloris, they can fuse optical data from satellites with radar data from satellites to directly measure the biomass at a 10 meter resolution across the whole continent and going back 23 years. So this provides us a way of getting access to that data, which is an order of magnitude cheaper and faster than what's been available before. So for us, this allows us to integrate data like that much earlier into the investment process. And we hope that with higher accuracy and integrity data out there, this will raise the bar in terms of what all forest-based projects are able to achieve, and also give data to supply chain companies who are interested in carbon stock changes from their sourcing areas.
It really is incredible how you mentioned 20 years ago just how much every aspect of life has changed because of these advances. It's mind-blowing if you stop to think about it.
It is, but I think our space has been slow to uptake. We've had revolutions in smartphones and internet communications, but a lot of what has been coming to market over the last 5 years or so has been based on technology that was around 10 or 15 years ago. I think today we stand in the middle of a revolution where these technologies are now starting to be deployed into projects. We're starting to see the benefits of those now in terms of much better accuracy and resolution of data and lower costs.
Well, that's interesting. Any thoughts on why the lag?
I think it's about the demand that there's been for the data. The carbon markets are getting more and more discerning in terms of the quality of information that's being provided, and so are buyers and so are investors. So now that we're asking for more, developers are having to go to market and look for those technologies. Previously, maybe a lot of this work was grant financed or public sector financed, and the bar just maybe wasn't as high in terms of what was being requested in terms of information flowing from these projects.
It all sounds so positive, but are there any challenges raised by these new methods in terms of evaluating projects for investors generally?
One challenge is rolling up data. So what a developer might need for complying with standards and reporting to buyers might be a different level from what, say, investors need, and what investors like ourselves need might be different from that which asset owners who invested in our fund might need. To address this issue, one thing we've done is come up with an impact reporting and management platform. So we gather impact data across 12 KPIs from all of our projects and then report that to our investors in a dynamic format. So rather than just getting a static number and a picture in a PDF saying what's been achieved, you actually get a database that you can interrogate and click on and see what's behind the impact, the headline impact numbers that are being presented.
You gave me a nice segue into our next subject here, Adam, so thank you. Around regulation and the role that it plays in terms of these types of investments, right now we're talking about voluntary carbon markets, the operative word being voluntary. From your experience, how do you see this evolving?
Yeah, the main action today is in the voluntary market. That's where the highest volume of credits are being transacted, where the biggest market value is. And despite the fact we've seen significant growth over the last 5 or so years, we're still very much in the foothills of where this is going. I think it's the MSCI's data that shows by 2030, this market could grow up to 13x, and by 2050 up to 38x. So there's still significant growth left in the voluntary carbon market. We're really just at the beginning. But it is true that the compliance markets are growing as well. And as they grow, they tend to overlap and probably to a large extent consume voluntary carbon markets. Now, for us, that's really a good thing. Our strategy is to take stakes in developers and projects that create the emissions reductions, the environmental benefits. Then over time, those developers can always pivot to serve the highest paying markets. And typically compliance markets do pay more than voluntary. So we welcome that change as these compliance markets grow.
So as an investor, why engage with the voluntary market now if you don't have to?
The voluntary market's much bigger than the compliance market in terms of demand now and is expected to grow. Despite the recent growth, being only in the foothills, I think this is an excellent opportunity for investors to get involved. We're working now with developers that we hope will become the next big companies in terms of landscape restoration, sustainable management, and protection in the future. This is an economy we move towards more natural capital destructive activities and natural capital restorative activities.
During our pre-production meeting, I remember you mentioned, you put it that the economy was at a tipping point, and basically we would really need to, I guess, rewire the whole thing so that it was not only not destructive to natural capital, as you pointed out, but constructive, that it's additive. Walk us through what you meant by that.
Yeah, so throughout history, economic activities have depleted natural capital, and this simply cannot continue. So the Stockholm Resilience Institute, they assessed things and found that of 9 planetary boundaries, 9 limitations on what our planet can hold in terms of impact that our economy is having, 6 have already been crossed and we're into dangerous levels. And if you look at agreements we've made from the IPCC on climate change, the Convention on Biodiversity, national and corporate commitments, we've had agreement from top to the bottom that we need to change the way the economy works. We need to switch it from one where the economy depletes nature to one where it restores it. And one of the most powerful tools we have today is a price on carbon. And with the prices we're seeing today, so sort of $15 to $60 a ton, every land-based activity that happens needs to be underwritten with a new business plan and faces an opportunity when underwritten with a new business plan. So one exciting thing is that with the prices we're seeing today, this is triggering an incredible breadth of innovation in terms of new project types like fire management on grasslands, biochar, enhanced work weathering, but then also massive expansion of more mature technologies like tree planting. So to give you an example, in Brazil, we've committed $58 million to Mombac to scale up replanting of the Amazon on degraded pastures. This investment has been made possible because of price commitments that we've achieved and long-term offtake from the likes of Microsoft and McLaren.
So is it fair to say we're at, let's call it a all-hands-on-deck moment of history?
Very much so. I think to hit the targets that we've set ourselves as an economy and in the various international agreements, we need everything, everywhere, all at once. And as the old saying goes, the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago, but the next best time is today. So we need to get cracking.
That's all for this week. Our thanks to Adam and to all of you for joining us. If you haven't had a chance to listen to the previous carbon markets discussion, you can find that episode, Step Right Up for the Voluntary Carbon Markets, at the bottom of this episode page on msci.com. You'll also find insights from Head of Carbon Markets Guy Turner and the rest of his team. Next up on the program, we'll take out our microscopes to examine disruption in biopharmaceuticals. This includes new techniques and breakthroughs, and of course, what it all means for investors. Until then, I'm your host, Adam Bass, and this is MSCI Perspectives.